Hello, it's Wednesday, 14th of July. I'm Hannah Pearson from Pear Anderson.
And I'm Gary Bauerman from Check in Asia.
Today, we are casting a bewildered eye across the travel and tourism landscape in Southeast Asia and asking, how did we get from there to here?
Yes, on this week's show, we're cataloguing some of the most unpredictable outcomes from the first 6.5 months of 2020. So, let's get started. This is the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Hello, wherever you are in the world, and thanks for listening in. While it's no secret that the first half of 2020 has been a disaster for the entire travel industry. In combination, the coronavirus pandemic and government responses to suppress the virus have seen the demand factor diminish, in many cases, to zero.
Yeah, in some parts of the world, notably South America, Africa, Middle East, and the US, COVID-19 is still raging. In pockets of Asia like India, Indonesia, Philippines, and even Singapore, infection rates remain stubbornly high. While in Hong Kong and Japan this week, the cusp of a coronavirus return has resulted in renewed restrictions.
Yep. So let's pause and rewind. A couple of weeks ago, Gary wrote an article for Travel Daily that I loved called 20 Travel Outcomes No One Could Have Predicted in 2020. So we've decided to slightly adapt it for this show with a Southeast Asian spin to it.
Yeah, so the unpredictable outcomes that we're going to discuss are in no particular order, but we do have 20 of them. So let's kick off, Hannah. What's your first pick?
My first pick has to be that the UNWTO would publish the following phrase: 100% of global destinations now have COVID-19 travel restrictions. And it did that on 28th of April, and that's just unimaginable, isn't it? Can you imagine at the beginning of the year if you had thought that the whole world would be imposing travel restrictions on one another?
Yeah, the destinations would have travel restrictions, government travel bans, airlines grounding their fleets. Mm. As we said in the intro there, the demand factor and the supply factor in travel went almost to zero in March, April, and May, probably saw the start of things moving in domestically. But yeah, you couldn't have predicted 6 months ago that the UNWTO would be saying 100% of the world's destinations would basically ban tourism.
Next pick.
Next pick. Okay, so moving from a global view to a local view, Singapore Changi Airport, which we talk about many times on the show.
Our favourite.
One of Asia's primary connective hubs that handled 68.3 million passengers in 2019 and earned its 8th consecutive Skytrax World Best Airport Award. It would temporarily operate from only 2 of its 4 terminals, so closing 2 of its terminals, and defer for 2 years construction of Terminal 5. Yeah. Now this, when you look at that, when you actually look at 2 of its terminals that are operating, one is closed temporarily, one is going to be closed, I think, for 2 years because they're going to completely renovate it.
Yeah.
They were going to do that anyway, but they expedited it and brought it forward. But T5 was, you know, we've seen Jewel, which opened, what was that, about 2 years ago?
Yeah, something like that.
Beautifully, you know, very high-tech new terminal. And T5 was supposed to be a sort of a kind of extension of that, but maybe for lower-cost airlines. But that's not going to happen anytime soon now.
Yeah, and I guess Singapore has really seen the fallout of this because they've got no domestic flights. So it's not even that they've got to keep the terminals open for domestic flights like many other airports have done. It's just there's no international flights or very little transit flights now. So no point keeping the terminals open, right?
No, absolutely. And this, I think what's happened at Changi Airport is emblematic of our region because it is the biggest hub. You know, it is the biggest connective international hub. It's the best airport by some distance. And the fact that they've had to reduce down their operating capacity for the near future, I mean, we don't know when the other terminals will open again. That really explains just how unpredictable this year has been.
Yeah, I think, like you say, the worrying thing is them really postponing T5 for 2 years. That really indicates they're not seeing this recovery coming anytime soon. Are they? They're being super realistic about it and saying there's not even any point, you know, spending on capex. Let's just focus on what we've got. You know, maybe air capacity won't return to those levels. It could be, couldn't it? Maybe not even in 2 years' time, in which case do they really need that fifth terminal? Do they need the additional expenditure? Maybe not.
Absolutely. And yet you rewind back to November last year and, you know, the growth trajectory seemed that T5 was a really logical investment. It made sense.
Yeah.
All of a sudden it doesn't. That's how far we've come.
That's 2020 for you.
Yeah. So, pick number three.
Pick number three. Oh, this has to be Cambodia. Okay. So, And I think they have earned some infamous press, I guess, in the last couple of months, because who would have thought a country would be asking inbound visitors to deposit $3,000 on arrival and to itemize what their cremation cost would be.
Yeah.
So $1,500, if you're wondering. I checked that up. That's just crazy, isn't it?
It is. And, you know, this was one of those announcements that came, it was probably about a couple of months ago now. It was in the height of the crisis. A lot of tourism boards and governments were looking for ways to try and lead a recovery of sorts, if that was even possible. And I remember that when Cambodia actually published the story in its local press, it said that Cambodia is leading the way out with a new way of looking at international tourism. Mm. Unfortunately, it hadn't actually bothered to ask its own tourism industry.
Yeah.
Tour operators were furious about this.
Yeah.
It immediately got picked up worldwide, saying, well, if this is the future, then nobody's going to be a part of it.
Yeah.
And it, you know, it had to backtrack quite quickly. But it was a terrible error, and it was an error at the wrong time.
Mm.
It was the wrong statement made at the wrong time.
Yeah.
And the legacy of that is, you know, consumers remember that figure. They remember that $3,000 figure, and even if you lift it or even you partially change it, people are going to want to see absolute clarification that that isn't going to be the case.
Yeah, I mean, and it's a little, I think it's just the phrasing on, well, I mean, the decision to charge this $3,000 because the travelers also have to have a $50,000 insurance policy. Anyhow, so people kind of argue, well, this insurance policy would cover these charges. But, you know, other countries are charging for tests and have told, you know, I think Singapore has told travelers that they would have to pay for medical expenses and things on arrival, but perhaps they didn't go into such itemized detail as meals and laundry and cremation. So that could have been another fly in the ointment, I think, for Cambodia trying to do this.
Yeah, yeah, that listing cremation cost was possibly not something it will look back on with any great pride.
Yeah.
So my next pick, Hannah, I'm going to look at outbound markets.
Okay.
I'm going to look at a country that is probably, for both of us, is a favourite destination, and that's Australia. Now, who would have predicted at the beginning of, at the end of last year, that Australia would most likely shut its doors to tourists maybe for the whole of 2020.
Yep.
Now, the reason that I picked out Australia, you could say any other country, but Australia, obviously, towards the end of last year, had these devastating bushfires, which really, really harmed its economy and its tourism sector in particular. And, you know, there was this hope that as the regeneration of the country would happen in 2020, that tourists would flow back.
Yeah.
As we know, it's a popular destination for tourists from our region. I had a quick look at the figures for last year. Now, Australia, at the, in the year ending December 2019, attracted 9.46 million tourists.
Okay.
And 1.5 million of those were from Southeast Asia.
So it's quite a significant inbound market to Australia, then.
Absolutely is. And if you look at the key markets, Singapore contributed 478,000 visitors to Australia last year. That's a big number.
Yeah.
Malaysia, 385,000. Indonesia, 221,000.
Yeah.
Philippines, 158,000, and Vietnam, 123,000. Those are big figures.
Yeah.
Even if you divide those down across the year, you know, that's monthly, month on month, there's a lot of arrivals there. So all of that is gone for a year. And, you know, what then what happens to the recovery in 2021? Qantas is saying that it probably won't even be realigning its fleet to even the second or quarter of next year.
Yeah, so even if demand picks up and travel restrictions lift, are they going to be able to get there? Maybe not.
No, Australia is currently, obviously, like most countries in around the world, relying on domestic tourism for the foreseeable future. You know, there was this idea of travel bubbles. We may talk about those in a minute. But, you know, Southeast Asia was really developing as a key inbound region for it. And, you know, this year that looks like there won't be any of that.
My next pick, cruise ships being used for offshore quarantine. So we've always thought of cruise ships as being fun places, you know, well, pre-pandemic, let's say, anyway, fun places, freedom to do lots and lots of activities. But we then, of course, COVID-19 hit. We had the Diamond Princess in Japan, and all of that negative publicity surrounding cruise ships ensued, and pretty soon they were stopped. There is still a few docked in Singapore, and Singapore struggled. Suddenly they had a spike in infections in their foreign workers. So these foreign workers were typically crammed into quite close close quarters, not much space in their dormitories. So the government decided that they'd use cruise ships that were harboured in Singapore instead. Which is quite a smart idea, I suppose, isn't it? Taking use of that. And for the cruise ships themselves, I guess it was a good test case to see how robust they are at being able to kind of minimize spread of infection.
Yeah. So you mentioned the cruise ship that was docked in Yokohama in Japan, which, you know, there were a lot of infected passengers on board. There was one also that docked in Sydney.
Yeah.
A lot of them around the world. And then we saw in Southeast Asia that a lot of these ships that were basically had nowhere to go.
Yeah.
Were being prevented even docking at some of the ports, usual ports in the region. But this irony is that, you know, they then become the safety, the quarantine area, when most countries around the world were using hotels, because hotels were empty. The irony, of course, using the hotels is that in Melbourne, it seems that the infection spike in Melbourne came from quarantine passengers in quarantined infected cases in hotels. But yeah, using cruise ships is
it
was quite a novel idea, but it does seem to have worked.
It does seem to have worked. So there we go.
So my next pick. Imagine spending 110 days living in Manila Airport, Hannah.
I'd rather not think
of that. Now that's what happened to an Estonian traveler who got caught coming from Bangkok to Manila. Exactly the wrong time.
Oh, no.
So just at the time when Philippines stopped issuing visas, and his return flight back to Bangkok, I think, was about 2 weeks later. And at that time, the return flights stopped. So he was basically caught stateless at Manila Airport. He lived there for 110 days. Initially, he was living in the departures lounge, eating in the restaurants, showering in the public facilities. And then I think the Estonian embassy managed to get him moved to one of the lounges, one of the airport lounges. And eventually he managed to get home.
Oh, he's got home.
He's actually gone home. I think he got home on the 8th of July. So it was 110 days marooned in Manila Airport.
Oh, no. I was just saying to Gary earlier, I was trying to think what would be the worst airport in Southeast Asia to be stuck in. I'm not really sure. I think maybe Jakarta might be in there. So listeners, let us know what would be the worst airport for you to be stuck in Southeast Asia.
Any airport for 110 days is going to be pretty awful.
Changi would be quite nice.
Changi would be okay. KLA too wouldn't be great.
No, end up naming the cockroaches.
So what's your next pick, Hannah?
My next pick, I think it would just be all of these new terms, you know, that we never really used before. Furlough, lockdowns, travel bans. And then this is just something that we say. Just that, the weirdness of it. When you step back for a minute and you think, wow, that life has completely changed, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has. I mean, it's not just the language of travel that's changed. It's the language of everyday life.
Yeah. Even my son, I was thinking this, he's 2 years old. His words that he says now, mask, thermometer. It's crazy that even he's adapted to this new normal.
It's true. And I mean, I've said this before, I do quite a lot of work in the consumer sectors. We do consumer reports in different countries of the region. You know, this move in terms of the whole terminology of healthcare-related products, you know, they are so hot right now. And they're being so super segmented to actually work out, you know, which is going to sell now, which one's going to be sold next month. And the whole health, wellness, fitness, personal well-being idea was there before.
Yep.
I mean, this has just been expedited by the pandemic. But it has actually shifted the sort of focus of how people are going to spend not just their discretionary income, but their actual essential income going forward. Yeah, we would never have predicted that.
No. Next.
Next. Okay. So let's look at hotels, Hannah. We've discussed these before. Now, who would have predicted that in, I think it was in June this year, a hotel operations director would publicly state that housekeeping, so having your room cleaned, could deploy electrostatic spraying technology, which uses the highest classification of disinfectants. Now, that to me sounds quite scary. Now, this was actually said, this was in Brunei. This was a hotelier in Brunei. But obviously, they're not alone. You know, perhaps they just stated what other hotels around the world are doing. So there has been this whole reboot of cleaning and disinfecting and hygiene standards in hotels, which, you know, that wasn't really a focus before. It certainly wasn't the way that hotels were presenting themselves as being clean and safe. And I noticed yesterday there's a hotel in Jakarta which is actually promoting itself. This is actually its USP right now, as it is the first hotel in Indonesia to jointly hold the Hazard Analysis Critical Control Point Certificate and the Safeguard Label from Bureau Veritas. Again, it just all sounds so scary. They actually have to promote themselves as having hazard analysis in a hotel. Would that make you want to go and stay there?
No, it wouldn't. It just makes you think of hazards, doesn't it? It's not a relaxing.
I just think of people in hazmat suits and you know, sort of chemical outbreaks or you know, these horror movies or things like that. It's that's where we've come to over the last 6.5 months.
Scary.
Let's not scare ourselves too much, Hannah.
Yes,
next pick.
Exactly. My next pick. I think it would have to be all of these tourism boards renaming themselves and rebranding themselves. So the classic one in Thailand is Amazing Thailand going to Amazing Trusted Thailand. So again, it's this kind of shift that we've seen from hotels into emphasizing destinations being clean, being safe, being a worry-free destination, instead of emphasizing this experiential element to it. That's where it was going before, right? It was going towards more and more experiential, localized experiences, and now that's out of the window, and it's just, you're not going to catch COVID here.
Indonesia joined in this week. It launched its Indonesia Care, which is a similar thing. Philippines said it will issue health and safety protocols for tourism sector and MICE this week.
Yeah.
So it is moving at the moment quite quickly towards, you know, hygiene safe, trusted, those kinds of things. But, you know, that's a 360 degree shift, as you just said there, Hannah, from the way tourism was being marketed six months ago.
Yeah, you wouldn't have expected that.
No, you really wouldn't.
Next pick.
Okay, my next pick is going to be... Now, if you remember, we've talked about this before on the pod, Hannah, where data was becoming used very specifically in the way destinations were marketing themselves, where they were targeting the future, they were using previous data, they were using real-time data wherever they could to project the future. Not just destinations, but hotels, airlines. Mm-hmm. You know, the industry was becoming very, very data-centric.
Yes.
There is no data to use right now. So who would have predicted really that by July, the only way really that all of these travel industry planners and marketers can budget and plan for the future is using consumer travel sentiment surveys, which are tick box surveys, which, you know, you ask a simple question, you tend to get a simple answer.
Yeah.
These surveys aren't very nuanced. They're not really asking much detail. They're basically saying, would you go to this destination next month if you could travel? Yeah. Which are your favorite destinations you want to go to in future? You know, and, you know, if you and I were asked those questions, I'm not sure that our answers, while they may be true, are actually going to give any idea to that's what we're going to do in future.
Yeah.
If somebody said to me, where would you like to go? I'll say Russia, but I'm not going to go there.
Yeah. Right, exactly. Yeah, it's not really taking into account the very nuanced, will you have to go in quarantine there? Will you have to go in quarantine when you come back? Are there flights to get there?
You
have to put down a $3,000 deposit. Are the airfares going to be twice the price that they used to be? It's a funny way of looking at it. And I know some companies are still trying to take quite a data-driven approach. I think you've got companies like Cirium or Forward Keys and all these guys who are monitoring what people are searching for on GDS, what they're searching for on OTAs. But again, whether that search necessarily translates to actual booking and correlates to demand is hard.
I mean, we've quoted many times on this podcast, you know, the OAG figures, the regular weekly updates of what's happening in terms of capacities and how that's changing. Yep. That is really useful to the industry.
Yeah.
But I sat in, and I won't name the company, I sat in on a webinar last week, which was an economic forecasting company.
Mm.
And they were looking at the figures this year for the economies of Southeast Asia and the potential rebound for next year. Now, obviously, all of the countries this year are in deep, deep trouble. We've seen that with Singapore today, 12.6% quarterly contraction. They're now officially in
recession.
But the figures that it was putting forward for this year look realistic. Vietnam, obviously, is one of the few countries in the whole region that may grow this year.
Mm.
But the rebound figures for next year were extremely strong.
Yeah.
But that is relying on the fact there will not be a second wave. And somebody actually asked a question saying, do they take into account the fact that we have no idea, you know, if we have a clear run through now to next year for the economies to grow that way? And they said no, they hadn't taken that into account. That to me is astonishing. Yeah. How can you forecast based on guesswork?
Yeah, it's kind of throwing all of that up into the air at the moment, isn't it? And all of these forecasts that look kind of set in stone at the beginning of the year.
I mean, we've seen in the tourism sector over recent years, when countries or airlines or anything, anybody starts to plan too far ahead, those forecasts become subject to a number of vulnerabilities, even in ordinary times.
Yeah.
Right now, I think planning beyond the end of this year is taking a huge stake on your own reputation.
And that just makes things like planning for flight routes, like we were saying, the Qantas and things, is incredibly difficult.
Yeah. So, next pick.
Next pick. My pick would be that Chinese travellers would stop coming. Right? Who would have thought that at the beginning of the year? You know, the whole world, Southeast Asia especially, have been so reliant on Chinese outbound travellers generating revenue for them, making up the lion's share of arrival numbers, and for that number to suddenly disappear.
Yeah.
Right? Unthinkable.
Yeah. And not just that. Not just that the world would shut out Chinese travellers. The world has shut out every traveller.
Yes.
But in some cases, we've seen in ASEAN, you know, these ideas of actually granting special visa access or even no visa access. At the moment, that's all off the radar right now. So you know, a lot of those privileges that were granted to entice more Chinese travellers, not just Chinese travellers, but particularly Chinese travellers, because the market's so big, that's all gone. I mean, you would never have predicted that 7 months ago.
No way. No.
And, of course, at the moment, the Chinese border is actually closed, so that there isn't any outbound travel from China right now. Yeah. We don't quite know when that's going to happen.
Mm.
But for as we've discussed in we did a special edition of this a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
Well, this region is heavily reliant on inbound travel from
China. So, next pick.
Next pick is... Okay, next pick. Again, we've mentioned this before, Hannah, that the airline industry has been hit so hard, but it is so vital to the carrying of the entire travel industry in the region. So earlier in the year, IATA, which is the International Air Transport Association, predicted that throughout this year, 2020, global air passenger demand would fall 54.7% compared to 2019. 54.7%. That's a huge figure. And in Asia Pacific, I think it was going to be one of the hardest hit regions. That figure was 53.8%. Now, I looked at the updated figures from IATA, and it's still saying a 54% drop in global demand. It's saying airline revenue losses for the whole year, this is astonishing, $419 billion. And a total of 7.5 million flights will be cancelled worldwide this year.
It's unbelievable.
Almost impossible to imagine.
Yeah. I mean, and linked on that, of course, for Southeast Asia is what's happening to the airlines right now. So Air Asia fighting for survival. They've got this material uncertainty. Although I imagine that most airlines probably have that comment in their auditors' reports right now. You know, their stock's plummeting last week, and I think they say they need, what is it, 1 billion ringgit, something like that, to carry on. 2 billion would be nice, I think Tony said. Knock Scoots closing. Thai Airways going into a rehabilitation process by the government. All of these things, I mean, to a certain extent, perhaps they may have happened eventually. I mean, from what I have read, Knock Scoot was not doing particularly well anyway. I think Thai Airways had great problems, but it probably wouldn't have happened so soon and not all at the same time.
Yeah, yeah. And the problem with AirAsia, of course, is, well, actually, if you look at the figures, it announced this, what, 950 million ringgit loss for the first quarter of this year, but that compared to 100 million profit at the same period the year before.
Yeah.
But it's privately owned. So, you know, the state carriers, Thai Airways, has gone into this sort of Chapter 11 kind of turnaround. It's not totally state-owned. And actually, the government has reduced its share down. So it's less than 50%, but it still does get patronage from the government. And so most of the carriers in the region have had some degree of support from their governments, but obviously the private ones are the ones that are very vulnerable. AirAsia is very vulnerable, particularly because it has a lot of flights to and from China. But also, as Tony Fernandez said this week, they basically had no revenue for 4 months. And when you have such a big fleet, you have such a big staff, and you're used to carrying high costs, because airlines like that do carry high costs, they operate on a relatively small margin. Very difficult to survive.
Definitely not something that anybody could have predicted, I think, at the beginning of the year. Next.
Absolutely not. So the next pick is for me. And I'm going to go back to, you mentioned this slightly, is the word travel bubble.
Mm, yeah.
Travel bubble. I wonder if Scott Morrison, who's the Prime Minister of Australia, realized what he was unleashing on the world here.
Trademarked.
He should have trademarked this phrase, because he said back at the beginning of May, I think it was, that Australia was going to keep its borders closed, but it may, and he did stress the word may, introduce travel bubble with New Zealand.
Mm.
Potentially in future, that could have been some of the Pacific Islands, but it was specifically to begin with
New Zealand and
Australia. Now, that never really got off the ground, quite simply because in both countries, the virus returned.
Mm.
They didn't stay COVID safe, and there are a number of reasons for that. But this term travel bubble, which has been sort of extrapolated into air corridors and green lanes, is being used by all around the world, particularly in our region. You can't really read a newspaper without one country promising new discussions about travel bubbles. The problem with that is that obviously the actual context of Australia and New Zealand being two island nations, they do live in a bubble. You know, they were able to actually confine themselves to traveling between those two regions if that's what they were going to do. Most of the countries in our region that talk about these have land borders, and it's a very, very different scenario.
That's true.
But, you know, this word travel bubble doesn't go away, but also at the same time, we haven't seen any bubbles actually
materialize. Yeah, just lots of talk.
Yeah. It's been great for the media, though. The media have used this.
Yeah. I mean, in my weekly report that I put together, I think I must use the word travel bubble probably 50 times every week.
I think we've used it on the podcast a fair few times.
Sick of it. And so my last pick for the pod this week, I think that would be this concept of travel tomorrow, where it started. I mean, can you imagine last year if all the countries and all the NTOs and everyone had said, guys, don't travel today, travel tomorrow. That wouldn't have happened.
Just think about that for a minute. And this was supported by the UNWTO, which is, you know, the greatest promoter of travel and tourism around the world. Actually, hashtag travel tomorrow. And tourism boards were putting this on their websites. They talk about it in their... Now, this has dissipated a little bit now because everybody's trying to get things moving again. But, you know, that just that concept that you're actually asking consumers to stop, think, and replan for the future, just totally unpredictable.
Right. It's almost absurd, actually, when you take a step back and you really think about it.
We've said this before. We started this podcast because we believe that Southeast Asia was the most dynamic tourism region in the world. And we still do believe that.
Absolutely.
We do believe that will come back. But we would never have believed when we set this up, we were talking about setting this up a year ago, that we would be talking about things called travel tomorrow.
Yeah.
It just would never have registered in our consciousness.
No, absolutely.
Or anybody, or any traveller. You know, if you'd have gone to any airport or sat on any plane and said, do you think that next year you actually might not be able to travel when you want to travel? They would have looked at you as though you were crazy.
Yeah, but yet that's the reality now, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's gone, and actually it's flipped the other way. So you ask a lot of people in the street or, you know, people that you meet, you know, when do you think you'll be able to travel again? And they don't know. They say, well, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I'm not sure when I will be able to travel or when I'll feel like traveling again.
It's completely the inverse. Amazing.
So travel recovery is the concept that, you know, this umbrella concept that the industry is looking for now around the world, not just here in Southeast Asia. Europe, particular, has really moved ahead with some sort of summer recovery if it can manage that. You know, Europe has the benefit that so many people travel across borders. You know, a lot of people don't fly; they actually drive between countries.
Yeah.
But here in Southeast Asia, we don't have the borders open, so at the moment, that's not even.
No, so I mean, we have our domestic travel recovery, but of course, as we keep saying, there's still this big shortfall between what international tourism expenditure can bring in and domestic travel expenditure. So we are still a long, long way away from travel recovery yet.
But let's stay optimistic.
It's going to happen.
Let's stay optimistic. Let's stay very optimistic. Because we want to travel. So let's hope.
So that brings us to the end of this week's edition of the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Yeah, it sure does. We hope you enjoyed this issue. And as always, we'd love to hear your thoughts and comments on the unexpected travel outcomes that you've experienced so far in 2020. So please send us a note. The usual addresses, by email at hello@thescasiatravelshow.com, on Facebook, The SEA Travel Show, or on Twitter, SEA Travel Show.
And we're seeing some thought-provoking comments and personal experiences on our LinkedIn page, The Southeast Asia Travel Show, so keep those coming. And of course, if you haven't listened to all of the previous podcast episodes, where were you? But you can listen to them all on the website, the seasiatravelshow.com, and on Spotify and Google Podcast. Just search for the Southeast Asia Travel Show on either platform.
Yeah, and a quick reminder for our Friday mini briefing newsletter, which features a different Asian destination each week. Last Friday was Thailand, and this week, Taiwan.
Mm.
You can sign up for free on our LinkedIn page or just send us a subscribe message.
And drumroll. Tune in this Friday for our brand new show, The Friday Rewind. We'll provide a short, incisive roundup of the week's key travel and tourism news here in Southeast Asia. We'll also have some guest presenters joining us in the coming weeks too.
Yep, looking forward to that. Well, that's a wrap for this week's podcast, Hannah.
Mm.
We're both off to scratch our heads and wonder how 2020 has unfolded the way that it has. And we look forward to talking Southeast Asia travel and tourism again this Friday.
Ooh.
On The Friday Rewind.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Bye-bye.